Hi, this is Josh Tabak. I'm here with my friend Jim Schumann. We are doing some Q&A, that's question and answer, for the Animator Island Q&A section. That's animatorisland.com. Our first question here is from someone whose screen name I can't read. So I'll just say, it's someone who does 3D animation mostly. I want to try 2D animation because it will improve my drawing skills and animation skills all at once. Do we have to have a strong drawing skill to animate in 2D? I would say
yes.
To start, you don't necessarily do. I mean, as anything, it's something you build up the skill to do. But animating and drawing are two separate skills. The better you draw, the easier time you'll have to animate because you'll be able to move things in space.
And in my experience, most of the CG animators that are really good, they have a really strong 2D background, 2D drawing background. It really helps them understand how to move shapes and sizes and densities and weight and balance.
Yes, when you're doing anything virtually, if you understand how it works in reality, it's always going to be, your brain's going to have an easier time figuring out what you want to do. So
draw.
Yeah, just keep drawing. The good thing about 2D animation is the more you do it, the better your drawing gets. It's actually, you start thinking more about animation and the movement, which is really the most important thing. As you see things like South Park, a lot of people say South Park isn't animated very well. But actually, if you watch South Park, it is animated very well. It's just super simple little puppets that are drawn or used. So while your brain's thinking about how you're moving it, through osmosis, you kind of are improving your drawing skill. It's just sort of, you're not worrying about it. You're not toiling over any specific drawings in particular. And as a result, by drawing 1, 2, 3, 10, 20, 40, hundreds of drawings, all of a sudden, one day you realize you're a lot better. And there aren't a lot of drawing practices that give you that type of platform other than animation. Wouldn't you say, Jim?
Absolutely.
And just a little quick bio on the two of us. Jim actually trained me. I came out here a number of years ago, and I worked.
1990.
I had an internship at Film Roman, and Jim had already been there, and he trained me. And then to go over quickly, I ended up getting a spot on The Simpsons, and I was in The Simpsons for a number of years. And then I ended up on Family Guy, and then I started directing on Randy Cunningham, Ninth Grade Ninja, for Disney XD, and did a little time at Nickelodeon on Wally Kazam. And now Jim and I are working on a new show for DreamWorks together. Are we allowed to say what it is?
Yeah.
It's called Boo. It's about ghosts. It's kind of all we can say at the moment. But I'm directing. Jim's a supervising director, and it's technically
Don't cut my credit, buddy.
All right, what is your credit?
Producer. Supervising producer.
That's even better.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right.
And this is technically the first time we will have worked together.
Yeah, so I tried to get Josh on Robot Monster, but he ignored me.
I did.
He didn't want to work with me. So.
Yeah, that was during my...
He was...
Yeah. Can't think of anything funny to say.
He was being belligerent.
Exactly. So why don't you give a little bit real quick of your...
Well, I started at Film Roman, and I was... there for about 9 years, and then from Film Roman, I went to Nickelodeon, and then Cartoon Network, and then back to Nickelodeon, because animation is a pretty nomadic experience. And then I did some stuff for some overseas international studios, and then most recently, like Josh said, I'm over here at DreamWorks Television, working on the show Boo. And I started I was one of those guys that was real fortunate, because I really learned on the job. I started as an in-betweener and just worked my way up from in-betweening to animation, layout, storyboard, timing, pretty much just all the way up.
And a lot of the positions have sort of kind of changed over the years and have a bit of a different job description from studio to studio. For the longest time when I was on The Simpsons, I was character layout, which in essence, without going into exactly what layout is, it was layout and key animation. We ended up keying out all the poses that was then sent overseas to be animated. I ended up moving up. I was assistant director and ended up in retakes for a while as well. and that's a whole other department, but did a little bit of storyboarding. So my point of view comes from more of an animator than a storyboard artist, but I ended up with everything that I was doing, especially once I started directing, becoming much more well-rounded. Again, with animation, the more you do it, the better you get at it, and just by sheer experience, you know more about it because you've been there and you've made mistakes and successes. Anyhow, next question. This is more of a, not so much an artistic artist's question than it is a point of view, but Michael asks, why is there such a big gap between movies like Aladdin and Aladdin 2 and 3? The movies are right to DVD. The movies that are right to DVD looks, well, let's just say he says there's a big difference. what is that about? You want to start?
Yeah. It's basically time and budget. The budget and the time that they spend on the big features, theatrical features, is a lot more. There's a lot more people involved, a lot more money, a lot more time is spent, as opposed to the DVD features, or to the straight to DVD films. There's just the, like I said, they have to get them out quicker. There's a faster turnaround.
It varies, but the features that are released in the theater, they're all animated here.
Right.
Whereas the ones that go straight to DVD,
yeah,
some of it may be animated here, or they may do some key poses, but
right,
it's more like television animation where the storyboards are sent overseas, or sometimes the character layouts are sent overseas. So the performances and the animation isn't finessed. It's just accomplished.
Right. The TV ones don't have the same time, money, or resources, artistic resources.
So, yeah, there you go. So they try to focus more on story, and hopefully they succeed. Charlie Freeman asks, how do you draw good life drawings from models? Practice.
Practice, practice, practice.
Same way you get to Carnegie Hall.
You got to draw, 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 and try to seek out, if you can. One of the things that helped me when I was in college studying fine art was I had different teachers with different approaches to drawing the figure. I had one guy who was really precise and would use his pencil and his thumb to measure. I had another guy that was all about expression. So you have to try to seek out, whether it's classes or in school or picking up books on the old masters. You know, Da Vinci had a different way of drawing the figure than Michelangelo did and Botticelli did. So you have to kind of expose yourself to those different ways of doing it and kind of find your own style to get it makes you better.
Yeah, like take what they did and do it your own way. Also, when you are drawing from the model, when you're drawing in general, don't think that the drawing you're putting down at that moment has to be your final drawing. Don't think it's got to be the best thing you've ever done. You're learning. You're practicing. Most life drawing, unless you are doing some sort of portrait, is practice. So you're working out your kinks. You don't know what you can't do until you try it. You can't do it, and then you learn how to accomplish it. So, you know, get a drawing down. If it's not the best, don't sit there and try to erase it and make it better. Do another one. Do another one. Same pose, you know, if you want. Maybe move your chair and move it around. You're just getting the idea down. And again, the more you do it, it starts to become muscle memory, and your brain has its own muscle memory, and you just get better at it. Study your anatomy. Anatomy isn't as important, but what really helps you when you study the anatomy is you know what you're drawing. If you don't know anatomy and you're looking at a model and you're not sure how, say, a leg or an arm is built, if you don't know what's going on in there, you can't interpret what you're seeing. You don't want to copy a figure model. You want to be inspired by it and get the idea of what's going on. So you kind of look at it real quickly, or a little longer. And when you start to draw, if you know your anatomy, you're doing half of the looking in your brain because you understand how it's built. And you just check with the model for reference, not look at the model and copy exactly what you see. So the next question, actually this is a question we got a lot of, is what is the best program to draw in?
Jim? I prefer Photoshop, Corel Painter, and Storyboard Pro actually is a good drawing program.
Yeah, since I use Storyboard Pro every day, that's kind of where my brain sits. So I'm kind of in the mindset of how those brushes work, how drawing in vector works. So I really like it. For the most part, if I'm going to draw on the computer, I'm going to use Storyboard Pro. But every type of project that you're doing has a different feel. If I'm not using Storyboard Pro, I'm using Photoshop. It's one of the most widely used programs, applications there is. That being said, Sketchbook Pro is a big up-and-coming program. It's much less expensive, and there is a subscription base to it, I think, too, but that's like, I think, $25 a year. I don't think it's much at all. And a lot of people who do a lot of painting, do comic book stuff, use Sketchbook Pro. It's made by Autodesk, which is the people who make Maya. And they actually just added a timeline feature where you can animate in Sketchbook. Doesn't take up a lot of memory on your computer. It's not like I'm doing an ad. Anyway, I hear it's really great. I saw a bunch of stuff at the CTN Expo, and a lot of people seem to like it. So Photoshop, Storyboard Pro, Sketchbook Pro. But for the most part, whatever you're comfortable with. I saw a quote once that said, a good artist can draw with a burnt stick. And if you just practice with something enough, if you just practice enough, you'll be able to draw with almost anything. Anyhow, next question. All right, next year I start high school. Ava asks, next year I start high school and they don't have a good art program. I doubt I will grow as an artist there. Should I take after school classes?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Wherever you can. Because you're high school, when you start high school, you're what, 14, 15?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, look everywhere you can, whether it's someone who teaches privately or sometimes the local community colleges will have classes. Sometimes the city will have them. Look for your city.
Larger cities might even have independent classes that artists, right, or working artists in the industry are actually teaching themselves.
Yeah, private classes, because that happens a lot. So you're not alone. You just have to kind of look around for it.
There's also a lot of online classes nowadays, correspondence and through email or even just live lectures over video.
Yep.
And then a couple follow-up questions she has. By the time she graduates in 2018, goes to college, will there be careers in 2D animation?
Absolutely.
Yes, there will. It's everything kind of is cyclical. It goes up and down, peaks and valleys. There's a lot of 2D animation in television now. And even in feature animation, where there's a lot of computer CG projects, up until that CG point, everything's drawn. Development's drawn, storyboards are drawn, everything is drawn, and a lot of animation tests are drawn. And the television animation, the technology and the shows, they're getting much more ambitious. And it seems, I wouldn't be surprised by the time you graduate high school if 2D starts coming back to features, and because they find different avenues of doing it, it does become more cost effective. There'll always be some sort of drawing to be had, and you also got to think about what aspect of the animation industry that you end up doing. If you like animating, if you like storyboarding, or if you like
layout,
designing, there's a lot of different facets that you don't even know what you're going to end up liking to do or are good at. You may come across something you never even really heard of, and you find out that's what you're going to want to do for your career. So just be open to it. Keep drawing. Just follow what you like to do and what comes naturally to you. And then she asks about pay. Is it a really low chance that I will, one, get into a great animation college, and two, get a high-paying job in animation?
Well, as far as getting into the college, that's really up to you. I mean, there's a lot of places, a lot of colleges that a lot more than when we started, where you can get in for animation. As far as the pay, I mean, there's most of the shops, most of the studios out here in California and even in New York are union-based, so there's a union pay scale system for when you get in. Some of them are non-union, so it really depends.
If you go to the union website, I'm not sure the exact website, but if you just Google search Animation Guild California, they have a form on there that says what the union minimum and average is. You can see
for all the positions, everything from in-betweener to, layout artist, a storyboard artist, a director, producer. It is a very nomadic business, meaning that you go from one project to the next. It's rare that you get on a project like The Simpsons or SpongeBob, which lasts 20 years. So you learn to save your money and, you know, when not to spend and when to spend. But you can make a good living. I mean, there's people, we make a living at it. You just have to be really smart about it.
You know, there's a balance between the art and the money. But like Jim said, if you're smart about it, and you choose your projects that make you feel good as well as seem viable, there's always new shows coming up. That's the thing. That's one thing I learned, because I was on The Simpsons for a long time, and I didn't quite have the perspective of jumping around from show to show. But once I did, I realized that there's always a new show coming up. So there's always something popping up. And once you start to know more and more people, you got more and more people to talk to. And, you know, if you got a good work ethic and you do good work, people will want to work with you. So there you go, Ava. Ryan Gissel, asks, I would like to know what criticism professionals get from other professionals. Well, Jim always used to tell me I suck.
Now, you always want to seek out, you always want to look for people to give you objective criticism, a criticism that's really going to help you grow as an artist, and you should always look for people who are either as good or better than you for objective criticism. One of the things we run into as artists is that we have aunts and uncles and friends who like our stuff, but they like our stuff because they're our aunts, uncles, friends, moms, and dads. But that's not really objective criticism. So you should always seek that out. Sometimes you're going to hear things that you don't like, but it's to make you better. What you don't want to have, if you ever ask somebody for advice or criticism, is if they start dumping on your stuff, or they just start, you know, no one deserves that. If that happens, you just take your stuff and you walk away. But yeah, the short answer is you want to get good objective criticism that's going to help you.
Yeah, you want to try to also look for feedback. Like Jim said, someone may give you feedback that's more of their opinion. Like, they don't like it, or I wouldn't do it this way. And if they're your boss, you just got to sit there and listen and take it into stride and, you know, try to give them what they want. But the type of feedback that you want, or you want to give to others as you develop, is how can you make this better? What's good about it, and what could make it better? You should always be looking at your own drawing as, all right, this is good, what can be better? And then you have to balance the time it'll take you to toil over that drawing next to your deadline, or, you know, take what you learned on this drawing and make your next drawing better. This one's good enough. You got to learn what good enough is without compromising, you know, the quality. But don't let anyone, you know, you don't want to be a doormat and you don't want to be a jerk when you're giving advice. So don't take it personally. If someone does harsh on your stuff too much, take what you can from it. And it's about the drawing. Even though we are very personally attached to our work, when someone's going over your work, it's not about you. It's about the drawings. It's about the work. And you want to make it better. So if you look at it that way, you kind of see the road to improvement. That was a little long-winded. I apologize. Jim, you can give me a signal when I need to cut it. It's like the opposite of the stretch symbol. Yeah, you can just fall asleep. There you go. Devin's got a bunch of questions that I may actually have him email him back or email me. But the one thing that... What is your daily routine?
It's what? Soup.
Soup. It really depends. Depends how busy you are. Some people work better in the morning and kind of peter off in the afternoon. Some people... Like myself, I kind of get a second wind after lunch. I kind of do try to finish up or put a dent in what I was working on yesterday in the morning, and then I get a lot more done between lunch and the afternoon. There's meetings. Sometimes you'll have a pitch where the storyboard artists or whoever presents their work. You go over it. That could take all morning.
Mm-hmm. No, you bring up a good point. One thing that artists who get into this business don't realize is what Josh was just talking about, is that you have to really learn to manage your time. because it's a deadline-based business. It's not like you're drawing at home and you have no deadline, or you're drawing for friends and you have no deadline. There's deadlines because you're doing stuff for networks or for online or whatever. So there are deadlines. So you have to kind of, you know, you have to kind of figure out what that routine is and what's and where to focus your time to get the project done.
Yeah, there'll be times where you're out of there right on the dot at 6 o'clock every day, and then other times you'll be there till 8, 9, 10 o'clock. Not Jim. Yeah, no, I mean, I get everything done on time. All right. Again, software, we went over that. Let's see. Human asks, I'm a 2D animation student. I just started... and I read about moving holds in 2D animation. But because there are many tutorials that now talk about 3D, they talk about them, and I don't know if they are supposed to also be used in 2D. And she says that she has a hard time finding information on that. She said, do you just ease in or out a lot more?
You want to go first? Yeah, I think we both have. I mean, I think we're on the same page. Is whether it's 2D or CG, you know, moving holds are good. You know, as long as they don't become a distraction, you just want to have that character still seem lifelike, whether it's blinks, little head nods, or slight shifts in weight. I know, Josh, you were saying, like,
if you really need the character to be just held still, you don't want to feel the drawings. You don't want to feel that it's drawings. So, yes, you would slow into it, possibly, if it's a very slow move to a stop. You put it more in between into that hold. And then a moving hold, basically, is just you redraw the same drawing two or three times and cycle them, on usually on twos, because ones starts to jitter. If the line still is jittering, depending on your drawing, maybe you need another drawing for your hold, and it basically just cycles to just kind of give the line some life. You add a blink in there.
Yeah, and as far as CG, it's the same, you know, yeah, blink, or just a little head nod, a weight shift, and that should do it.
You just want
to... It's not distracting.
Exactly, that's what I meant by feeling, you don't want to feel the drawings, you don't want to notice it happening, it just needs to flow. So, there you go. Sit down, David. Would like to know. Will you do more drawings or tutorials about clothes and how to draw them better? Especially drapings and how you know where to put the lines of folds and stuff. I usually just put diagonal lines across the chest wherever, and it looks okay, but it just doesn't look like clothes to me, he says.
I mean, the best thing I could tell you is what I did when I got to the point when I had to do that is I just kept it really simple, and just flat out I'd steal stuff. I would look at, you know, I'd look at how other folks drew it better than I did, whether it was a simple little fold in the arm or the leg or the knee, and just kind of see how they did it and just kind of ape it or steal it or make it change a little bit to make it, you know, make it work for my style. Yeah. I also would look at a lot of the old masters who did a lot of clothing and cloth and paintings. And even then you see that they kept things pretty simple. A real favorite of mine is John Singer Sargent, the way he did clothes on people. Really kept it simple.
Yeah, it's like you can practice drawing it complicated and then find a way to simplify it. Basically, clothes wrinkle wherever there's a bend in the form, in your body, so at your knees, at the waist, at your sleeves. And then the next thing that helped me think about it more is gravity, that everything's trying to fall to the ground. So where's the cloth being held? Where is it draping? Where is it falling? And is that material thin? Is it thick? That's when you start getting into more details of like having it feel like velvet or feel like cotton, you know, some types of material have more wrinkles, some have fewer, but just like Jim said, look at what other people do, try to understand it, draw through, and just draw practice runs. Like, don't try to do a finished drawing, just do some drawings that you're just trying to figure out what the heck is happening here. And as you do that more and more, you'll start to understand it, and once you understand what you're drawing, you can draw it a lot quicker and easier. Alrighty, more questions about software. Some, I cannot pronounce this, Joe Malex, it's her screen name, or his. I'm coming around to my senior year in high school and have no idea how I can find my place as an animator. We kind of said this earlier. It's all, first of all, it's all on the internet.
Yeah, like, just honestly, just go online. Just search stuff. Look, I mean, it's everywhere.
Figure out or try to think about what is it you like to do. What do you like to focus on? Do you like to animate? Do you like to do storyboards like a comic book? Do you like to draw vehicles and environments, backgrounds? Figure out what you like to do, and then hopefully that is also what you're good at. And then find where that fits into the industry, and you'll find your place. It's not as complicated as everyone thinks it is. It's just not something that's every day, so it seems to be more of a mystery than it is. I think these are the last couple questions here, but they're good ones. Florence asks, my question is, is there a way you can tell what are the keyframes when you are watching a professional animation? I wanted to try to get the keyframes to a movie and then see how I would animate the part and in between them myself and then time them, but she can't figure out where the keys are. I get the rest of this question. So she gave me an example from this Winnie the Pooh thing that she was looking at online, which is a great idea to actually get the keys and animate it yourself. Basically, the keys end up being the poses you can't not have. So if someone's sitting, from sitting to standing up, the first drawing is going to be they're sitting, and then the next drawing isn't necessarily going to be them standing up because they can't just pop up. It's when the body changes the most, or hand, or whatever it is. I'm just going to say body because it's what we're talking about.
Yeah, the extremes in the action.
Yeah, that's why it's called an extreme. I guess, what did you say? You said keyframes.
Keys extreme.
And you think of, if you think of the word extreme, it's like, what's the extreme pose? Without that pose, it ends up being another type of movement. So you need it. You would lean forward before you stand up. If you're going to grab something, your hand has to go from your side to the object, but your hand also has to open and then close, and then it picks up. So every time there's a major movement, a major pose change, that's an extreme.
It's kind of like I like to think of it as the high notes and the low notes on if you think of it on a musical scale, and then there's notes in between, or there's drawings in between of those high notes and those low notes. Those high notes and low notes there might be different pieces of time between them, but they're the extreme notes. And like Josh was saying, the extreme poses of action.
A couple of great books to look up are Eric Goldberg's The Animation Crash Course. I like that one a lot, but that's just me. And Richard Williams' Animator's Survival Kit. Jim's making fun of me.
No, they are. No, I was just kidding. They are. They're very good.
Between those
especially the Richard Williams.
Richard Williams' book is like an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
If you don't know a lot about animation, it might be a little overwhelming. That's why I would suggest start with the Eric Goldberg Animation Crash Course one. And the old Walter Foster books, I think it's got an elephant on the cover now. It's smaller. I can't remember the exact name.
And some of them they combine them.
Those are kind of. And then there's the illusion of life. Actually, I think explains what keyframes and extremes are very nicely. That's more of a coffee table book, but that was sort of our bible for the longest time. And then these other books came out. But if you check out all those books, the Eric Goldberg one really has a very succinct and simple way of looking at everything, and I think that'll help you understand it more. But also, the more you do it, you'll figure it out. I remember it was Aladdin at one time. I was in school, and I'm like, how do they even know what to do? Like, how do they know to make them do that? Like, what?
Well, they act it out.
Just it. And then I started to animate, and then as time went on, I remember a few years later watching Aladdin and going like, oh, they did this, this, and that. And I just saw it. The same scene from two different perspectives. Like, once I did it a lot, I understood what I was looking at much better. Let's see, we got our last question here. She says, also, sorry for more than one question, but how do you plan out if there's going to be something that has overshoots in a pose? Like, if you look at the Tigger scene that she mentioned, when he says something at the end, he really draws it out and it stretches, and like there's a moving hold. How do you plan a hold? Do you make up the top drawing and the key? Do you make the key before that and then go past it? I don't know what would be the key there or how to plan out with a timing chart. All those stuff we were saying kind of answers that.
Yeah. Just do your extreme. And then whether you're flipping it, rolling it, or doing a quick time or scrubbing through it, do your extreme, and then you'll see if you need an overshoot, how much of an overshoot. And the same thing with settles and cushions, you know.
Yeah, you rarely do you plan the overshoot and cushions first. You get all your main poses down, and when you start timing it out, you'll feel this bounces back too quickly from the extreme. So then, like, I think I need an overshoot, so there's more of a cushion. And you just, once you start playing with that, you'll just find it, and after some experience, you'll just be able to know ahead of time, I'm going to need an overshoot here, I'll do that later, and then you do it later, and it just all works in. It's just practice, just doing it. You seem pretty knowledgeable from your questions, so hopefully you'll actually listen to this. Well, that's all our questions for now.
That was great.
So, I'm going to say, if you have any more questions, send them to animatorislandqa@gmail.com. And we'll try to keep up with this. This was fun, and I like to hear all your questions. Jim seems to like it.
This is very cool.
Jim and I are both very into spreading the word. We had, again, like Jim mentored me when I first started out, and I had other people as well. And it's an industry that really needs to be the people come up and coming being nurtured, mm-hmm. being mentored, mm-hmm. and that's how it was done. You know, they say the 9 old men train the next group, and the next group train the next group, and that's kind of how it needs to be. It's mm-hmm. it's a very specified art form that you know needs to be.
It's a craft.
Yes,
it's a craft that gets passed down. You know, that's the best way to approach it.
Apprenticeship
because
mentality.
The one thing that you also learn in this business is that the person you may be helping, you may be working with and for someday. So everybody's in it together, you know. Everybody's in it together.
Yeah, I still think of things that people taught me, you know, my first year out here. They showed me something, and I still use it today. And I had a few people even say that to me. Yeah, I remember when you showed me this thing about drawing hands. I still do that, and I always think of you.
I get that when people have gas.
Yeah.
They say they think of me.
I know. I get that a lot as well.
Well, thanks. This is great, dude. Thanks.
Great. Well, thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you guys for listening. And keep coming back to Animator Island.